is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
The coronation of King Charles III. Since 1066, every English crown in that cathedral, except two minor details, one having to do with murder in the 15th century, another having to do with the abdication in the 20th century. But we come to what Charles III inherited the moment his mother passed away. 14 realms, Antigua and Barbuda, Australia, Bahamas, Belize, Canada, Grenada, Jamaica, New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, St. Kitts and Nevis, St. Lucia, St. Vincent, the Grenadines, Solomon Islands, and Tuvalu. I welcome Gregory Copley, who's a national of one of those realms, Australia, because this is all new to me. Gregory forgives me for having not had an education in kingship in the 20th century because America had this dispute in the 18th and 19th century with Mother Britain, enjoying on television the coronation of King Charles III was a way to reconnect to the original understanding of the British Isles and the Empire of Great Britain. Gregory, a very good day to you. Thank you. You witnessed this as well, but your education as a colonial is way ahead of mine. What did you sense you were seeing Charles project in the presentation that he made? He designed this. He followed through with it. It was his coronation. What did he? What's the message that he conveyed to those 14 realms and indeed the rest of the planet? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Well, every British monarch is entitled to shape his or her coronation to reflect their values and their hopes. What we saw with the coronation of King Charles III and Queen Camilla was the reality that the king had now entered into that binding social contract with his people in the United Kingdom and the Commonwealth. And that was different from just being named king as successor to his mother, Queen Elizabeth, when she died on September the 8th last year. So the ceremony of the coronation, which is a coronation, a crowning, an anointment, and an enthronement, literally spells the, for want of a better word, mystical commitment of the crown to the people and vice versa, which was why the audience at the cathedral and the public at large were asked to reciprocate King Charles' commitment of loyalty, many, including myself, did so at that time. It is a social contract, and that's something which we don't see today in most republics and most modern so-called democracies, which are drifting away from that entire explicit commitment to a social contract between governed and governors. And without that social contract, you tend to become subject to the government. The people become subject to the government rather than the government subject to the people. And this is what the coronation wanted to spell out. There's some debate as to whether King Charles, quote, modernized the ceremony to an undue degree to take away a little of that mysticism. But he did add to that the gravitas of the situation by ensuring that there were, I think, something like 19 new pieces of music, mostly classical, which were part of the service at Westminster Abbey, which were written expressly for this coronation. And they will endure and be some of them will be used in later coronation ceremonies by the successor generations down the line. So it was important from that point of view. It was important also that the king used the ceremony to try to cover as many of the other aspects of the United Kingdom and the Commonwealth as he could, particularly the realms, as you pointed out. He had, as all recent British monarchs have had, they had the stone of destiny, the stone of Scone from Scone Palace in Scotland, which was brought down from Scotland to be placed under the coronation throne, coronation chair, so that that represented King Charles also being named King of Scotland, quite separately from King of the United Kingdom. In the old days, it was the King of England and the King of Scotland. And it was the joining of the two thrones which actually started the whole process of creating the United Kingdom. I think there is some argument for saying that King Charles may have been advised to at least consider having a separate ceremony in Scotland, either at the Holyrood Palace in Edinburgh or at Scone itself, where the ancient Scottish kings were crowned. And in fact, at least one King of England and Scotland jointly was crowned there, particularly that was Charles II, before he was able to come back and retake all of England with the death of Oliver Cromwell. But the situation is that there is a degree of mysticism. Again, the question is raised and has been raised for some time. How do you extend this sense of a bond to the Commonwealth realms and the rest of the Commonwealth? Because as you point out, there are several Commonwealth countries which have moved to a form of republicanism and away from having the British or the United Kingdom sovereign as the sovereign of their state as well. In the case of Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, it's not the sovereign of the United Kingdom who is the sovereign of those countries. Those countries themselves name the sovereign as the king or queen of Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. So literally, the king is now King Charles II of Canada, King Charles III of Canada, King Charles III of Australia, King Charles III of New Zealand, that quite uniquely. So in those countries, his capacity as sovereign is actually separate from his capacity as sovereign of the United Kingdom. His role as head of the Commonwealth, however, transcends all of that, because he's also head of the Commonwealth for the Republican members of the Commonwealth, as well as the monarchies in the Commonwealth.
Gregory, I was struck in the course of this, the hour and a half, how very different it is from our understanding of religion. Charles was clearly not the leader of the ceremony. It was the Archbishop of Canterbury. And I heard very clearly at one point that he was loyal to, swears fealty to, being Protestantism. Again, a striking contrast with the United States understanding of no state religion. It is clear that Charles is the king of the religion, the Anglican religion, centered at the in the Archbishop as a missionary of the Christ. And I noted the two moments I think we didn't see Charles was when he was anointed in private ceremony. So he's not only a servant of the people, he's a servant of Lord God Almighty and his son.
That is absolutely correct. He is constitutionally the head of the Church of England. Now, as we've seen made clear by Queen Elizabeth, and even more explicitly by King Charles, is that they welcome the defense of all faiths. But he is, his specific title, defender of the faith, is the faith of Anglican Protestantism. And even that was too much for the Scots to bear, because the Scottish enthronement ceremonies are not religious. They are literally led by the peers of Scotland. And yes, there is a Presbyterian element to the coronations in Scotland, but there it's not a religious ceremony as it is in England, and therefore for the United Kingdom. But the reality is that a real asset of the crown is its dominion over the Church of England, and yes, the chief executive of that is the Archbishop of Canterbury, but the sovereign is the chairman of the board. And there was a question even raised by then Prince Charles, Prince of Wales, as to whether he would declare himself defender of the faith. or rather defender of all faith. And he opted for the tradition, which is defender of the faith, with the clear understanding that he would defend the rights of all his people in the United Kingdom and the Commonwealth to practice whatever faith they believed in. And, of course, what we did see at the ceremony was a Hindu prime minister of the United Kingdom delivering the Christian message from the pulpit. And we saw a lot of other Christian denominations, in other words, Catholic, Orthodox, and the like, all represented at the coronation. And as the king left Westminster Abbey, he met with Muslim and Jewish leaders of the United Kingdom as well. So he was very keen to make sure that he is there to protect freedom of religion.
I'm speaking with Gregory Copley. We're reflecting on what John learned from watching the coronation of King Charles III. There's some details here which we're going to pick up. Gregory is a national of Australia, and you mentioned the Prime Minister of Great Britain, certainly Rishi Sunak, but also in the room, in the cathedral, and entering notably with the Governor General was the Prime Minister of Australia. And so I want to speak when we come back of the relationship between Australia and the United Kingdom, represented by this forward-looking defense alliance called AUKUS. Certainly, it was in no king's mind in the 17th, 18th, and 19th century that someday the United Kingdom would be a partner of Australia. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Battle.